the implication for Black women is this notion that you will be this caregiver and take care of everybody else. You have no needs or desires of your own, and that you can just be this workhorse and work until you collapse, and you do it with a smile on your face.
From UW Tacoma, this is Pod Defiance.
Welcome to Pod Defiance, where we don't lecture, but we do educate. I'm Eric Wilson Edge. Today on the pod, UW Tacoma professor Carolyn West. During her prolific career, Dr. West has researched the connection between domestic violence committed against Black women and larger forces like historical trauma. Dr. West has also researched how Black women are portrayed in the mainstream media and in adult films. We'll talk about this, and we'll also talk about the increase in domestic violence during COVID, or, as West describes, the pandemic within a pandemic.
Dr. Carolyn West, thank you so much for joining us today on Pod Defiance.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with, so you do a lot of research on domestic violence and intimate partner violence. We are now more than a year into the pandemic, and I'm curious, what are we seeing locally and nationally when it comes to issues of domestic violence and intimate partner violence?
What we're definitely seeing is an uptick in rates of domestic violence. It's still early, though. I think we have to get to the other side of the pandemic and then look backwards to see how how COVID has really impacted things. But what I'm seeing within my research and in the field, the people that I'm working with, we're seeing that COVID really has exacerbated intimate partner violence. It had always been there and been with us, but with the economic downturn, with people isolated at home, it's more intense. It's making it more difficult for survivors to get access to resources. It's a huge thing. And we're also seeing an uptick in the local area here within Pierce County, King County. We're seeing increasing rates of domestic homicides. So it's really a pandemic within a pandemic. And so we need to be really aware of what's happening with intimate partner violence.
You know, it's interesting. And one of the things I appreciate about your research is you tend to focus on things that don't get a lot of coverage in mainstream publications or in the press. I have not heard a lot about this issue until I started looking at your work. And another thing you talk about that I think is really interesting is this idea about there's this connection, right, between Black women and the intimate partner violence they may experience. But it doesn't live in a vacuum. You make the argument that it's tied to other forces like historical trauma. So I wonder if you can talk about how this relationship works, like how they're connected.
You know, that's a really good question. And I've been thinking been writing about this for decades. As you said, I'm a domestic violence researcher. I'm a clinical psychologist by training, but my area of focus has been on gender-based violence broadly in the lives of Black women and other marginalized women. And it just seems very intuitive to me that, of course, we should not just talk about intimate partner violence as it's this separate thing that just involves an individual or couples. It's deeply embedded in other forms of violence, and we can't separate those things out. And what I mean by that is I think we need to consider historical trauma. Historical trauma is that deeply rooted trauma that many people of color, marginalized populations will experience. You see it impacting Native populations. You see it impacting people who are Jewish, and what happened during the Holocaust. So historical trauma impacts many different populations, but I focus on African American populations in particular. And I'll give you an example about why I think this is important. I'm the granddaughter and great-granddaughter of sharecroppers, and they lived in Arkansas through some pretty difficult times in this country's history. So Jim Crow laws that determined where you could eat, where you could work, what form of transportation you could have, where you could live, and just deep economic disadvantage. And that kind of historical trauma shapes how you see yourself, how you see your relationships. Lynchings, they lived through lynchings and people being brutally murdered. And that shapes your ability to function in the world, even though they were remarkably resilient. It did have a deep impact on them. And it teaches you how to value or not value your life and the lives of other people who look like you. And that gets passed down generationally, and it impacts your ability to parent and function in the world. So that shapes how you experience, it influences higher rates of intimate partner violence. It also influences economics, which means you have less access to wealth and you're less healthy, which then influences future generations of violence. So that's why I think it's important to look at historical trauma.
So how do we break this cycle, and how do we end domestic violence and intimate partner violence?
I think, you know, I'm a big believer in therapy, that we have to kind of get to the root of what's causing this. So oftentimes people who are involved in intimate partner violence, there's a historical background, family background of that. So if we can really work with people to help them find healthier ways to resolve conflict, that could be important. But we also have to look at how this is deeply rooted in structural inequality. So poverty, homelessness, all those lack of access to resources is critical too. We can't just think of this as an individual problem. So making sure that people have access to housing, access to jobs, access to things where they can live a better life, and reduce that level of stress. And we also have to think about institutional violence. So if you can't turn to the police, you can't turn to medical services and social services, make sure that when people reach out to those services, they can get help that is culturally appropriate. All of those things need to happen. So we need to take a systemic approach to dealing with this problem.
I know you are involved locally with a project called Survivors First. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about that project.
That project, I'm very passionate about that project right now. These are women. What we find is that African American women and women of color are getting arrested at disproportionately higher rates because of the domestic violence in their lives. So they may be doing things like using physical force to fight back against an abusive partner, or they may be involved in things like retail theft because they're trying to get the resources they need to leave a violent relationship. So Survivors First is an innovative project where we're asking the prosecutors to take a second look. If somebody has used violence to escape an abusive partner, we're saying, well, maybe arresting them is not the solution. Maybe we need to get them connected to therapy or a housing or employment services to help them get out of that situation rather than just incarcerating them. So that's kind of the premise of the program right now. So right now I'm looking at the data, talking to these survivors to say, hey, what can we do to, how can we be of service so that you're not in this situation in the future? And so really my goal is to figure out ways we can change the legal system and educate people who work in the legal system so that they could be more responsive to survivors rather than just criminalizing them.
That reminds me of, and I can't remember the name of the woman, it was a few years ago, there was that case that was in the national news. I can't remember the details, but she was maybe being trafficked, or in some way she's being held against her will, or there was some violence perpetrated against her, and I think she ended up killing the person, but then they sent her to prison for a very long time.
There have been numerous cases of that. Marissa Alexander, who fired off a warning shot in Florida against an abusive partner, and she was facing decades in prison as a result of that. That's what we're trying to look at. We're trying to take a more nuanced approach to this. And of course, I'm not saying it's fine to just start shooting at people. That it's much more complicated than that. But looking at all the dynamics of an abusive relationship to understand what's going on there and how we can intervene. Because we can't arrest our way out of the problem of domestic violence. It's too complicated.
Do you know how this issue breaks down in terms of race? Does this happen more for Black women who are victims of this sort of violence and who take action? Or is this something that happens sort of universally the same?
We do see Black women actually having somewhat higher rates of being arrested as a result of domestic violence because they're oftentimes faced with more serious types of violence. So they're more likely to be victims of things like attempted homicide. They're more likely to be victims of strangulation more than other ethnic groups. And they're more likely to be victims of what we call reproductive coercion. So they're at risk for being sexually victimized within these violent relationships as well. So all of those things kind of co-occur. So that may be why we're seeing higher rates of Black women being arrested.
If you'd like to learn more about Dr. West's work, I encourage you to visit her website, drcarolynwest.com. Here you'll find links to her book, as well as different scholarly publications her research has appeared in. There are also links to different news and magazine articles that feature Dr. West. We'll include a link to her website in the episode description.
One of the things that really intrigues me about the work that you do, and I think this makes for a good segue, is that you often get called as an expert witness for trials related to issues of domestic violence. I wonder if you could talk about this experience, your role, and you know how that goes for you. It feels like it could be both incredibly stressful and incredibly rewarding at the same time.
It is. It's some of the most challenging work that I do. And I'm very careful about the cases that I take regarding that, but it is incredibly rewarding, but also incredibly difficult and heartbreaking. Oftentimes I get called when the female victim has killed her partner in self-defense. So that may involve everything from looking at autopsy reports, interviewing the survivor, going into jails, prisons, interviewing the survivor, and getting a sense of her background and the sense of the dynamics in that violent relationship that contributed to it. I might look at hospital reports, a lot of time spending looking at police reports, and really kind of focusing on the trajectory of that violent relationship. And then I go into the court and I talk to the lawyers and the judges, and I will do an assessment, like a danger assessment, to get a sense of the level of risk that woman was facing, and then just talk to the jury members and the lawyers about why the dynamics of that relationship contributed to her using lethal violence against her partner.
Are you ever, or has there ever been a time when you've been concerned for your safety, when you've been an expert witness?
When you're sitting in the courtroom, somebody has lost a loved one. And that then, regardless of what's happened there, we're all more than the worst thing that we've ever done. And I really believe that. And so even though this perpetrator may have used very violent behavior with his partner, I still never lose sight of the fact that the person is no longer here. So they're not here to make those changes where they can be nonviolent with their partner. And so there's loss and sadness and trauma and grief on all sides. And it's a situation where it feels sometimes where there are no winners in this. And nobody's going to go away happy, certainly. So I'm very careful to disconnect from it. I go testify and then I leave. And then I extricate myself from the lives of these individuals so that I'm not carrying that around. But it's difficult. It's very difficult work. Emotionally, it's very difficult. And then there are some cases that just never leave you.
So one of these things, one part of your research that I want to get into is talking about media portrayals of Black women. And I'd like to focus on three. One is, and I'm putting this title in this in quotes, the mammy. And then there's also the angry Black woman and the superwoman. So I'd like to know, I'd like you to provide maybe a little bit of history of each and then talk about the impact these sort of tropes or stereotypes have not only on Black women, but on society as a whole.
Yeah, so this is another area of my research that I'm very passionate about too. So I wrote an article in 1995 when I was a postdoctoral student where I just really wanted to articulate how I thought these images impacted Black women. And that article was called Mammy, Sapphire, and Jezebel and the Psychological Impact on Black Women. So the mammy image has been around actually for a very long time, hundreds of years. And that image actually arose after the Civil War, sort of a way to make slavery appear benign and benevolent. Because historically, there wasn't very much evidence that this kind of happy, jovial mammy image existed, but it was this image of this. She was usually depicted as obese, very happy, a caregiver who's happy to take care of the white family, and her hair was covered in a bandana. She was usually depicted as very dark skinned, asexual, the opposite of what physical beauty was in our society. That image really has an impact. So after that image became very popularized, we saw it in Gone with the Wind, for example. And it just took off, and you saw it on a lot of products for food. Aunt Jemima pancakes syrup was very popular. And that image of this kind of obese mammy who was an excellent cook was on that product for more than 100 years. And the implication for Black women is this notion that you will be this caregiver and take care of everybody else. You have no needs or desires of your own, and that you can just be this workhorse and work until you collapse, and you do it with a smile on your face. And then we saw this kind of angry, aggressive Black woman arise. It was called a sapphire image, and there was an old Amos and Andy radio show in the 40s, and then it became a TV show, and there was a character called Sapphire, and she was very angry, aggressive, sort of verbally abusive to her husband, but it was made to sort of be comedic and funny. And so this kind of notion that Black women are angry, aggressive, out of control, and will just snap your head off in a minute. We're still living with that image too. I noticed that the new vice president, Harris, she was oftentimes called angry, aggressive, just a nasty woman. So that image really gets projected on Black women such that we can't express ourselves fully because you're always fearful of evoking that image. So it's a way of really silencing Black women. There's this kind of superwoman image that we can do it all. And it's kind of a morphing of mammy image of a kind of a caregiver. So we just swoop in with our cape or superwoman cape and we don't need to sleep. We don't need to eat. We can manage everybody's problems and we have no concerns or needs of our own. And so those are common tropes that are depicted throughout our culture that we're still very much living with and need to change.
You know, it's thinking about your, when you're talking about the mammy image, it got me thinking that I wonder, you know, it feels so much about sort of that mythology that came after the Civil War ended about the lost cause. And I really feel like the mammy sort of plays into this idea. Like, you know, it feels like it plays into this narrative that still exists today that you hear still that it wasn't that bad, or enslaved people had it better than after after they were free, which, you know, you might, if that is true, then you really have to wonder why that would be. Like, if the situation is so much worse afterwards, that's not a compliment. That's not saying anything good.
Yeah, exactly. So that image, it was just, it was put on all kinds of products. And it gives the impression that this is the natural status for Black women, that you will be constantly in service. And if you're not smiling and happy, then there must be something really wrong. And so it was a way, it was part of that lost cause to sanitize and make slavery seem really benign and benevolent. Everybody was happy and it wasn't as, it erases that historical trauma of what it really was.
Now, your research also goes to a place that I don't know that a lot of researchers go, but I think that's meant as a compliment because, you know, the pornography business is huge. It's so big. It's hard to overstate how big it is. And so you look at how Black women are portrayed in pornography. So kind of the same idea we were talking about, like, you know, what are sort of the common ways they are portrayed and, you know, what is the impact of these sorts of ways of portraying these folks?
Well, you know, to my defense, I did not set out to be a porn researcher. That happened sort of by accident. I had been doing the research on images of Black women in the media for decades, and I was talking to a group of my colleagues, and we had started an academic journal called Sexualization, Media, and Society, and they were all looking at pornography. And I asked the question, well, is anybody looking at race in pornography? And nobody wanted to touch that topic. And so I thought, well, I should go look and see what's there. And what I was finding is that the images of women in pornography are problematic, to say the least. And they were worse with African-American women. And so there tended to be this hierarchy of beauty where darker-skinned Black women with more African features were depicted even more negatively, and more violence was directed toward them. I was finding that Black women tended to be in the genre of a type of porn that was called gonzo porn, low-rate porn, cheaply produced, where they were oftentimes depicted in urban settings, ghettos, impoverished-type settings, and all of the terminology that was associated with it was linked to them. And I was seeing also Black women were called more like prostitutes, sex workers, more so than other racial groups. So there's another level of degradation that I was finding with those images within porn.
I wonder if you could give us a little bit of a discussion about your documentary, which I believe was called Let Me Tell You All About Black Chicks.
Yeah, so my documentary, Let Me Tell You All About Black Chicks, I take the title from a 1985 porn video. You have to understand, in the 80s, when the VCR became popular, people did not have to go to theaters to watch porn, and it really took off. People could watch it within the privacy of their own homes. And so we started to see this flood of interracial porn. And that video was taken off the market because it featured Black women performing with other performers who were dressed as Ku Klux Klan members. And so it was just seen as a bridge too far. But you can still find that on the internet. And it made me think, what does this stuff do to your humanity, your sense of sexuality, your perceptions of Black women when you are viewing these images? And so that's what prompted me to really start to look at pornography as a scholar and what I was finding. I really put it in historical context. These images and tropes that we see in pornography are deeply embedded in history, that these are not really new images. And I really unpack what this does to the psychological well-being of Black women and how we see them as victims of trafficking. And in my work as a domestic violence researcher, I was just finding that many of the young women who were victims of sex trafficking, there was also a pornography element to this, that purchasers, buyers of sex were using, they were watching lots of pornography themselves, and they were targeting women of color and getting an ideal about who women of color were from pornography. Many victims of trafficking were forced to make pornography. So the links, for me, it's really about understanding violence against women.
You have published books, scholarly articles, you've made documentaries, you're everywhere, in the Washington Post, New York Times, Essence. But now I understand that a documentary you're featured in is going to be screened at South by Southwest. For folks who don't know, it's this huge sort of film festival. In the industry, it's a pretty big deal. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that will be screening March 17th, and we're super excited about it. I'll share the final trailer with you when we finish making the changes there. And the documentary is called Subjects of Desire. And again, I just do the work that I'm passionate about. And I've been working on images of Black women in the media for decades. And the film producer in Canada saw the article and she reached out to me. And she wanted me to talk about those tropes that we just talked about, Mammy, Sapphire, and Jezebel, and just how they're related to beauty images, how they're related to how Black women feel about their skin tone, their hair texture, their weight, and their body type. And it was an opportunity to bring Black women from across the country to get together and talk about these beauty images and how they impact us and how they're deeply rooted in history, and how we can embrace our natural beauty and sort of push back on those historical tropes. So Subjects of Desire is our way of doing that, to really educate people about, you know, how Black women feel about beauty and how they have found ways to define their own beauty in a culture that tells them that their beauty is less than.
So we started our conversation talking about the pandemic, and I thought we could end it also talking about the pandemic. We're over a year into this now. So what lessons have you taken from this period?
I think for me, it's been an interesting time during this pandemic. And I've just really learned, with the type of research that I do, how important it is to just really practice self-care. And I think that one good thing that has come out of the pandemic is I hope that it encourages people to really get more in touch with their own authentic self. I think we're learning that life is just so incredibly fragile, and that tomorrow and things like physical health are not promised to us. So figuring out a way to make the world better through my research and scholarship is something that I've really learned during this time.
Thank you to our guests, and thank you for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe. You can find us on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts.